Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. To celebrate Halloween, this week's episode is magical. Acclaimed authors Danielle Clayton and Jacqueline Woodson discuss Clayton's recent middle grade debut, The Marvelers, a fantasy adventure set in a global magic school in the sky. This conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, at the inaugural American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Welcome, everyone. If that music had gone on any longer, I was going to start doing a little dance up here. My name is Allison Zanzoni. I'm the program director of the American Writers Museum. I want to thank you all for being here today and for joining us for this program at the American Writers Festival. We're welcoming to the stage two extraordinary writers whose work has shown a new generation of children how to see themselves in stories of adventure, dreams, and now magic. They're fierce advocates for the freedom to read and the expansive lives that people can create once they open themselves up to literature. In Danielle Clayton's The Marvelers, a global magic school in the sky invites children from all over the world to practice their cultural arts. It's her first middle grade book. She's the author of the Tiny Pretty Things series, recently adapted by Netflix, and the Bells series. She earned an MA in children's literature from Hollins University and an MFA in writing for children at the New School. Now she's librarian at Harlem Village Academies, is one of the We Need Diverse Books librarians, and co-founder of Cake Literary. She's here today with Jacqueline Woodson, recipient of a 2020 MacArthur Fellowship, the 2020 Hans Christian Andersen Award, the 2018 Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, and the 2018 Children's Literature Legacy Award. And she was the 2018-2019 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Her New York Times bestselling memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, won the National Book Award, as well as the Coretta Scott King Award, Newbery Honor, and many other awards. She also wrote the adult books Red at the Bone, a New York Times bestseller, and Another Brooklyn, a 2016 National Book Award finalist. Her dozens of books for young readers include Coretta Scott King Award and NAACP Image Award winner Before the Ever After, New York Times bestsellers The Year We Learned to Fly, The Day You Begin, and Harbor Me. Please welcome both Jacqueline Woodson and Danielle Clayton to the stage.
Hi, everyone.
Thanks for being here. So, Danielle and I are going to have a conversation about writing and magic and a whole bunch of other stuff. I don't know how many of you have read Danielle's latest book, The Marvelers, but Marvelers, but it's phenomenal. And I just went for my second round. So in the book, there are, I would say, I'm not going to call them factions, but I want you to talk about first and foremost. The Marvelers, the Conjurers, and the Aces. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about?
Sure. So first of all, I'm so excited to be here with you to talk through my first middle grade debut, which is about a magic school in the sky. Mm-hmm. And so I created this world where we are in our world, but there are several different groups, several different magical people. And the one magical people that is sort of the largest is a group called the Marvelers. And they believe that people who have magic are born with a light inside of them, which is their marvel, which is what is marvelous about them. And they decided to leave the regular world behind and live in the skies. They built three cities that move all over the world and a school for their young people to attend in order to practice their marvels. And they are very much not wanting to be around people who don't have magic, but also another group. So there's a group called the Conjurers who were left down with the non-magical people when the Marvelers decided to take to the skies. Mm-hmm. And their magic is deemed a little too different, a little strange. And so they allow the Conjurers to visit their cities, to work in their homes, to shop. But they have to go home because their magic has been stigmatized. It has been thought of as a little too strange. And so that's the other group. And then the Aces are my sort of villains. The Ace of Anarchy is my villain, and she has a group of other villainous people that help her do her bidding. So you picked up on all my all my groups.
And then there is in the book, and I shouldn't talk about it as though people have read it because it just came out May 2nd. So, but I'm just fascinated because I write realistic fiction.
Yes.
It's not a genre that I move into that often. And I was fascinated by how someone coming from realistic fiction saw so many things that were familiar. And I kept saying, oh, I can't wait to ask Danielle, is this intentional? Is this intentional? One thing that happens is our main character's aunt has gone missing. And I was thinking about, in this country right now, there's so many young black and brown women going missing and not being investigated to the extent that other people are being investigated. So I wondered, in terms of some of the things you deal with in the book, how you got to those stories. I mean, you also deal with restorative justice. You talk about restorative justice in the book. Segregation, obviously, and this sense of just the different ways, and teachers, and the different ways that people teach. So from that pedagogical level, all of that is in there. And I guess I'm, I hadn't thought that I could come to these kind of real life situations in magical realism and fiction. Mm-hmm. So
that's why I'm so excited to talk to you, because I feel like we're writing from a similar tradition, but mm-hmm. mine has magic and yes. yours is rooted in the real world. But all of my magical sort of thematics are rooted in real world stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when I sat down to write this book, I was thinking about my parents, who were some of the first kids to integrate schools in the South in the 60s. So my dad is from Mississippi, my mom is from North Carolina. And I remember growing up talking to them about what that was like, because they were the only kids. Mm-hmm. And very much like my experience, I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in Maryland, and I was one of maybe three black kids in my class. And so I very much felt like I also was moving into spaces, and I wanted to write about a little kid who was an ambassador, who was forced to be an ambassador for her community and her culture and be a representative. And what does that burden feel like when you're the only, and when your group has been stigmatized and you have to navigate spaces that are so different? In this, we've got, you know, magic is laid on top of that, but it's still, I was very much inspired by Ruby Bridges, inspired by the civil rights movement, and what it means to open up your community when you've kept people out. So everything sort of has a real world anchor, and then I just made it magical to be able to have a different kind of conversation with young people.
I love it. I was just thinking about when I went to college, my family didn't have much money, and we didn't have a car. And so my dad borrowed a car from someone, and he and my mom and I piled in it, and I had one trunk, and we drove to Long Island for me to go to college. And everybody else had all their rooms were like decked out, and I had my little, I was like, oh, you're supposed to, you know, fix up your room. Like, there was so much I didn't know, but getting into that environment and then seeing my parents in the mirror of it, and suddenly thinking, wow, we're not enough. You know, there's a moment, because I had grown up in predominantly black and brown spaces where we all had the same things, and if we didn't, we shared. And then coming outside of that. And so when she ends up at Arcane, mm-hmm. don't tell me, is it? Don't tell me. Arcanum?
Yeah, or Arcanum, whatever you
Arcanum
want.
Arcanum Academy at the school, and her whole family comes, and mom has an alligator, and dad, what's his animal?
He has a frog. Little frog.
Can you describe dad for the audience?
Sure.
I love this depiction of him.
Yes, so Ella's family is a very famous family in the conjurer world. Her dad basically, conjurer magic is rooted in this idea of crossing. So all of the conjurers are descendant from West African marvelers who were trafficked during the transatlantic slave trade. And that changed their magic. And so it meant that their magic was rooted in this idea of crossing. They can cross between life and death. They can cross because they crossed oceans. They can cross into the underworld. They can cross into the will of plants and animals. And so Ella's father is basically like the king of the underworld, essentially. And so they're very afraid of him. He wears a top hat with animated skulls. And every conjurer, when they turn 13, they get a companion. And this is an animal that is supposed to guide them for the rest of their life, even through the underworld, and protect them. But before that, conjurer parents can speak to their children and whisper into their minds, because I believed that that was a way to keep children safe, especially Black children, if their parents were constantly giving them, you know, advice and guidance. And so Dad is a very cool character. He's got a lot of history. He sued the Marveler government to make sure his kid could go to that school. And so he is a very divisive figure, but he has a little frog that hides underneath his top hat. That's his companion for the rest of his life, too. His wife has an alligator named Gumbo, because kids love, come on. Can you imagine if you had an alligator sitting right here?
I'm scared of alligators, and I loved Gumbo.
Yes, know? He's chubby, and he just comes along, and it's an interesting, kids love it, so they're really into it.
How did you get to magic?
That is such a great question, because so many of us didn't. I got to magic because my dad was a comic book nerd, and he loved reading, and he loves reading. And so every weekend, we went to the bookstore and the comic book store. So I grew up around comic books and sort of all of those big sci-fi fantasy books. He was reading Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy. I remember books on tape on the way to school. We were listening to Stephen King's The Gunslinger. So I was surrounded by magic, unlike a lot of my peers, because my dad loves it. Mm-hmm. So it was natural that I started writing this, because I kept asking him, well, where are all the Black people? Because mm-hmm. there don't exist in any of these worlds that you're listening to or that I have to listen to on the way to school. And he didn't have an answer for me. He was like, this is what publishing does. And so that's how I found my way. I was very interested in the supernatural, the fantastic, things that were spiritual. I loved this idea that there could be a ghost in the house. Or my grandmother was always like, put pennies in your shoes when we go to visit the graveyard. Like all these little spiritual things. Yeah. And that's where I found magic.
That's so funny, because I remember us holding a button, holding, you know, one of our buttons when we crossed over the graveyard. Mm-hmm. And so much of my magic, I think I got from my friends. You know, I'm super superstitious. any superstition, I'll take it. And, you know, if I spill salt, some is going over my shoulder.
That's
everything's
right.
Why take a chance, right? It's not going to hurt anyone to throw some salt over your shoulder. But growing up in a religious family, you know, my family was fundamentalist Christian. And there's a whole lot of magic in the Bible, but magic wasn't allowed in our house.
Interesting.
I remember my sister went to see Doug Henning, who was a magician, perform. And my grandmother was like, you're going to see that stuff. He's working with evil spirits by doing it. And I'm like, nah, it's just magic. But it's so interesting to read this book and remember the magic of our people. Like when I wrote Our People Could Fly, I wish I had written that book, but Virginia Hamilton did. Mm-hmm. But the year we learned to fly, and then going back and reading The People Could Fly, reading Virginia Hamilton's books, and the way she talks about the magic that came from Western Africa, from all over Africa, really kind of unlocked for me this idea that, yeah, we had this magic in our stories forever. We've had it in our ways of doing things, you know, sweep out a house before you move into it, sage, all of these ways in which we the way we talk to our ancestors. And also, I remember in another Brooklyn, in one section, one of the characters jumps off a banister and off a balcony. And whenever people ask what happened, I'm like, she flew. Yeah. And I some part of my brain, because I created her, that's what I believe happened. And they're like, did she kill herself? I'm like, she flew away. And I love that we still, even if we're not writing, there's some part of us that maintains that. But it is also interesting that we have people like Octavia Butler. We, you know, we have some history of it, but not a lot.
It's not a lot. And it's something that is very interesting that I wonder why I clung to it. I didn't read Octavia Butler until I was in my 20s. She wasn't given to me. Mm-hmm. Virginia Hamilton, yes. Mm-hmm. She probably filled my childhood imagination, and I am always trying to be like her in my work, where it's rooted in a Black American tradition but infused with magic, making all the things that we're talking about, these Black American superstitions, making them actually sort of real in a way is super important to me, because it felt like magic. I remember my grandmother would say, if a fork hit the floor, it meant a hungry man was coming to dinner, right?
Say what?
If you dropped a fork, in the house, my grandmother would say, a hungry man is coming to dinner. Make sure to look out the window, right? Like little things like that. And I thought it was real. So I'm like, who's coming to dinner? Who's coming, right? I would wait and wait and wait. And I thought, how do I make that magical, actual magic, so that kids who look like us, who are filling their creative wells, can also have their imaginations sort of grown and springboard? Because so many of us go to realistic fiction. And I always wonder, I'm in constant arguments with people that we know about magic and why they hate it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm the only person that loves magic in our group.
Funny. Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, the world of children's books is small. So we all talk and drink and talk and gossip and get together. But you don't have to name the name, but will you tell that story about the writer who didn't believe in magic?
Yes. Okay, so if you get the book, you'll see who I dedicated the book to. It's Jason Reynolds. If you don't know him, please read his work. It's phenomenal. But we've been in a series of arguments for like probably a decade about magic. He hates it. And he hates dragons. And so I dedicated the book to him. I said, you know, this book is for Jason Reynolds, who hates dragons. Beloved readers, please ask him why. So for the rest of his life, small children ask him why he hates dragons, because I am a troll, and that's what friends do. That's what friends are for. But he told me, he said that he felt like as a child, his imagination was taken from him very early by the nature of being a Black American boy. And he said he didn't have room for magic. And that made me incredibly sad, because I had so much room for magic. And I wanted to make sure that other kids that looked like him would be able to see themselves in magical settings and be able to imagine themselves as having powerful magic. And it's one of the reasons why there is a cute boy on my cover who loves magical animals and can talk to them. And I just wanted to be able to showcase that and help grow imaginations. That's what I think middle grade fiction does really well. But I do think something in our community where our kids don't get to have magic. They get to have the real. They have to be prepared and armed for what they're going to face and the hostility. And I wanted to find a way to build a bridge with
magic.
That's
so interesting, because you also have a girl who dislikes magic.
I do. She's more like me. So my main character, Ella, she loves magic. She loves where she comes from. She's also an ambassador from her community going into this other community. And she's just like, let me show you what conjurers can do. Let me show you like why you shouldn't be afraid, all of that, that we are awesome, which I felt like as a Black child I had to do, being one of two or three. I had to be this sort of perfect ambassador. But her roommate and her best friend at school is a grumpy white girl who hates everything. That was more like me. In middle school, I hated it. I just wanted to read my book. I don't want to be like, don't look at me. I'm reading my book. Leave me alone. Let me be up to my own devices. And she hates it. But she belongs more than my main character, because she's a legacy student. So I wanted to showcase that there are different ways that you can come at this idea of magic and whether you like it or not. But I do wish more of us would come into magical spaces. I don't know. Is it scary? Is it something that, when you're building your books and your worlds and what you want to write about?
You know, you're such an inspiration. I have to say that, because you really have had me thinking about that absence of it in the literature so many of us write for young people. And where, even as we struggle to not make it medicinal, right, it still is. I'm putting the real world on the page, and I'm going to put hope into it, and I'm going to talk about some of the harder things, and someone's going to get through it. And my question is, like, why can't magic help them get through it now? But it wasn't what I read as a kid. And I always think you write what you read. And it wasn't the way I always say I write because I have questions, not because I have the answers. And it wasn't a part of the questions I was asking, because it wasn't a part of the narrative I was living. So
that's fascinating too. So you write for questions, and for me, I write things that piss me off. So each book is something I'm mad about. So for the Marvelers, it's why do children who come from different communities have to be ambassadors for those communities, whether they're queer kids, whether they're Black kids, whether they're any, you know, kid of color, disabled kids who are neurodivergent, neuroatypical, why? And that was what frustrated me. And I was a teacher in East Harlem, New York. All of my students were first and second generation. immigrants from other places, and they kept asking me tough questions like, why am I not at Hogwarts? Why am I not in these magical universes that every other kid is talking about? But none of these people look like me. None of these people speak any of the languages that are spoken in my home or eat any of the food. And I thought, this is incredibly unfair for me as a librarian to try to get them excited about books, try to help them with their literacy, for them to not see themselves reflected. And I started working on this book so that they could never be forgotten. And that's why, really.
And what's the book where they made it into the Hunger Games? You know, there was the young black girl. She died very quickly. It's so interesting when they, too often, even when I look at movies like, it's not Land of the Lost, but the one about the dinosaurs, when you see the black character, it's like, he's out. He's gone.
He's going to get killed quickly.
First
one out. And I wanted to create a world where differences were celebrated, that every kind of kid is there. They speak different languages. Every kid wears a translation crystal so that they can communicate with their peers. I wanted it to feel global, but for us to have an honest conversation about community, who's allowed in, who's kept out. Even when we say that we're a global society or a multicultural society, we find ways to create difference. And just because you have magic doesn't mean that you are above bigotry and bias and prejudice. So,
such a good point.
Yeah.
Oof.
I know.
I had another question for you. So you're right. This is your first middle grade book, and it's going to be one in a series, right? Because it says Marvelers number one. Do you have a sense of how many you're going to write?
So I have four right now. So I'm working on the second one. Writing series are difficult, but it's a lot of fun too. But yes, there are four right now. There might be more.
And do you? They're going to be the same characters throughout. I can see your little sister growing up, and do you get tired of the characters when you have to spend four books with them?
I do get tired of the characters, and that just means that I have to make a change. I have to, like, push them to the edge. So I've written a couple of other series for young adult, but this will be my first middle grade one. So we'll see if I get tired by book three. But I think I love the world enough, and I love that kids are already falling in love with the world, that I want to make sure to do right by them so they can have all the books they want.
It's such a bejeweled world, too.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. Can you talk a little bit about, I know I have to leave time for y'all to ask questions, but can you talk a bit about TV, the world of TV?
Absolutely. So I had my first book that I wrote, Tiny Pretty Things, turned into a Netflix show. It's very racy, so if you do watch it, it's TVMA, which I wasn't excited about, but you
what
know
does
how
that mean for mature audiences?
It means mature audiences and lots of naked people.
That's a new thing with, because with young people and nudity and TV, right? That's so funny.
And I didn't know until I sat down to watch the pilot with my dad, and then he turned to me and he said, "You have all this sex in your book?" And I said, "No, sir, I do not. This is Hollywood. You know, this is what happens."
But
it was, oh my God, it was so bad. It was so embarrassing. I was like, "Don't look at me, Dad. Don't look at me." But yeah. So when you get a book adapted, Hollywood makes changes, and they don't really ask you your opinion on them. So I had to just roll with it. But for the rest of my adaptations that are coming, I'm much more involved so that the content doesn't go to TVMA and can be shown in schools, because my books don't have MA content in them. So it was frustrating. So
what else do you have coming?
So I wrote a book called Blackout with a bunch of other YA authors, and President Obama is making that into a TV show and into a movie, so that's coming. I'm going to be closing my movie deal for the Marvelers on Tuesday,
Yay!
So I'm very excited.
It's so visual,
yeah.
So it makes so much sense.
I was worried, though, because everyone told me that you can't write a magic school book in the age of Harry Potter, that we have the one true magic school. Everyone told me no, that it couldn't be done.
It's so different.
It's so different, right? However, right now, I'm getting swarmed by J.K. Rowling fans and trolls, like, sending me death threats and all kinds of things, and it's like, wow, this is how institutions are protected. Every day I wake up and I've got all these comments and threats in my messages because I've written a magic school book that could be threatening her legacy.
Wow.
And you would think, we write for children. Why would we be getting death threats?
Expand the World is
but
nutty.
Yes, no one wants any other book but Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And Harry Potter in that universe does not include so many of us. And that's why I created this world, so that every kid could actually put themselves in the world, not have to retcon and say, oh, well, she's got curly hair, so I'm going to be that person. Mm-hmm. No, it's on the page.
Yeah,
exactly.
And Rick Riordan, who blurbed it, which is so lovely, also writes in a magical world, but he gets to be separate because it's not a school. Like, how does that work?
Yes. So Rick Riordan, who's amazing, he gave me a blurb. He's actually not allowed to blurb.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Disney does not allow him to blurb. But he broke his agreement with them to blurb the Marvelers and say that he wanted to live in this world. And if you don't know who he is, he's incredible. He wrote the Percy Jackson series, which kids are in love with. And he's actually under fire right now, too, because he has a TV show on Disney Plus coming, and the cast just released. And one of the prominent major characters was casted as a black girl, and they've been attacking her. They got her social media shut down, and she's been swarmed every day. And he had to make a statement standing up for his Annabeth, which is his character. And he writes magic, too. He's using the Greek mythology for this one, but every kid got casted, and this little black girl has not had any rest since it was revealed.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he's been such an ally, too, for diverse books, for, you know, getting people their rewards in all ways, shapes, and forms. He's a really... It's so nice when the person is a great writer and a great person, too. I find... in our community that exists a lot. So
yes, I love, and he's incredible. He launched his own imprint at Disney Publishing where he boosts other authors writing their own mythology. Mm-hmm. And he goes on tour with them, he sets them up, and he really means it when he says he's an ally. So to see him getting attacked online, you know, I boosted him, and now I'm also. He messaged me. He was like, "Let's not answer any of these haters." I said, "I promise you, I will not reply." But you know, we're in the age of banning. We're in the age of all of this sort of online vitriol, and it's really, really tough. I mean, you've been in the crossfires for decades.
It's a long crossfire. But what I was saying to you, that's different, is now. The banning of books is getting legislated. So whereas before people were just like, get that book off our shelf. I remember at one point Miracles Boys was the most stolen book in a library. And we didn't know if people were just taking it off. This was in London, I think, off library shelves because they didn't want it there or because they wanted to have their own copy. But it was Harry Potter and the Miracles Boys. Those were the stolen books. So it was interesting. But yeah, I think it's such a critical time in terms of all the work we have to continue doing. I have a friend, Irvashi Vaid, who died sadly yesterday, who remains an activist and, you know, and a new ancestor activist. But she one thing she said was, you know, you shed the tears and then you get up in the morning and you go back to fighting. And I just feel like that's where we live as a society and trying to do the work to make ourselves, to keep surviving as a society. So.
And you would think, we're writing books for kids and getting attacked and threats and taking them away. And it's like, what are you so afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to ask people. I would love to show up at school board meetings and all that. What are you actually afraid of? Mm-hmm. Are you actually afraid that they see a certain word, or they're reading an experience that is not yours?
Mm-hmm.
They are people living in the world. They are young people that are going to have to interact with people that are not like them. Isn't it great to meet them in a book first?
It's so true. I remember I was in Michigan and I was doing a panel, and this teacher came up and said, you know, I really like your books, but I don't use them in my classroom because there's no one in my classroom that looks like your characters, like out loud. And I was like, oh God, please don't let me be the black person your students meet, the first black person your students meet. And this idea that the young people are going to exist in that bubble of that they're in for the rest of their lives, and that we don't want more for them, exactly. is always...
It's so foolish
yeah.
and ridiculous, because I had to, as the one of three black kids, I had to read about everyone who wasn't like me mm-hmm. my entire life. So you can read about me too. Mm-hmm. I do think I get to fly under the radar because I write fantasy because the parents aren't paying attention to fantasy. So it's kind of great. I'll wait for the Marvelers to get banned. I don't know. But I can just say, well, it's magic. So it's not real. And see how they do, but we'll figure it out. Right now, I'm just dealing with Harry Potter fans let me rest. Wow. Who knew? 25 years old, Harry is, and yet it's warriors. There are warriors out here for him.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and because J.K. Rowling has stepped in it big time and revealed herself as a transphobe, and so mm-hmm. people are having that conversation on top of it. Mm-hmm. So, and because I have queer kids in my books, they're mad about that, so... I know. It's wild. Oh, are we taking questions from the audience?
I think so. Does anyone have any questions for us?
And just a reminder, questions have question marks. That is my one teacher thing from 13 years in the classroom.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your books. I have a ninth grader and a seventh grader, and so I've been reading Middle Reader for 5 or 6 years now. And I was just in a conversation with my 13-year-old, and he was wondering, or he's wrestling with this idea of knowing he's two things as a multiracial young person, but only not necessarily feeling like he's both things. And I wonder how you wrestle with that, like in your stories and your characters around having these multiple identities, but not always feeling as deeply connected to all those identities.
I think we can both answer that. I have a multiracial family, and it's one of the things I think about as someone who is African-American, but my kids are biracial, and their half-siblings are different races. So we in our family, there's Korean, Puerto Rican, Irish, Jewish, like there's all of these things, and the kids connect to all of that, and they're... You know, I guess I should never say never, but they really, it's going to be hard. And maybe if I wrote it, they'd find all themselves in one book. But I do think that they do find themselves. Like my son, who's 14, is such a Jason Reynolds fan. And What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker is one of his favorite audio books. And that's a book about a black guy growing up in Pittsburgh. And he's like, that's me, 100%. It's like, not so much, honey. A, you grew up in Brooklyn. B, you know. But it's interesting because I never want a young person to come to the narrative and not see some part of themselves in it. And I never want them to have to compromise, feel like they're compromising. So I do hope that they I do write about biracial, multiracial families. I do write about families where there are two moms or a single mom or, you know, kids being raised in foster care and all of these ways that I know young people exist in the world. And my big hope is that what we're doing is we're creating the foundation for young people to write their stories, right? So I always think when I meet kids who come from these very... families that are different from what I know and what I see in the world, I'm like, I want that story. I want to see that story on the page because, A, it's an important story, and B, it's something that will wake me up more. So that's where I am with it, but it is an interesting thing. And when I'm writing picture books, sometimes I literally have to go in. I get to choose my illustrators, but I don't... I'm not allowed to talk to them once I choose them, but I've had cases where I've put in words, well, I'm thinking of Pecan Pie Baby, and the illustrator can't understand it, right? So I'm like, this Thanksgiving table is a multiracial table. Do I need to send you pictures of my Thanksgiving table so that, and you know, people, black people have more than one hairstyle, so like get rid of the piccanini braids and do something different with it. But those kind of, when you think about the person who is interpreting your words, they have a whole different idea. I know with Pecan Pie Baby, my daughter's biracial, and when the illustrator put the child on the page, the child was exactly my complexion. You know, the both people were the same complexion. And I... just gave up on that fight. But it's so interesting to see people's radar. My daughter said, she's in her second year of college, and she said, you know, there are families where everybody's the same color. and her mind was kind of blown by it because it's not the world we live in, but it's the world, obviously, a lot of people live in.
And that's why I think it's important when we're sitting down to the page to think about all of the different kinds of kids so that your kids can find a thread of themselves. That's the point for me, is that every kid can come to the world and see, oh, that's someone who's like me. That's a family like mine. And feel seen and feel like they can call this space home and feel safe in it. But for a long time, literature didn't do that. It wasn't safe for all kids.
I still want Gumbo. The alligator. It was like, that's my family. Exactly. And I think also, you know, like I was saying, going to college, when her family comes onto the page and they're messy and you know, and her mom can read her mind, so her thoughts are sometimes not her own. And they're just not like the other families. And you're getting whiplash looking at the others and looking at your own family. And also, there's so much love there, too, at the same time. The amount of love that this family exudes is so familiar to me. I love the complexity, and I love that, young people can come and find that.
I grew up with a very two set of smothering parents, right? And so...
Were you an only child?
No, I have a younger brother, but they're just all over me, like white on rice, is what my mom calls it. And so in the book, I showed that. There's no way I could go to boarding school and just be like, see ya, mom, talk to you later. No, she's coming. She's coming. All the other parents have been like, see ya, kids, go on. No, she's in there. She's unpacking the clothes. She's making the bed. She's checking everything out. And I was like, this is what my mother did to me at every sleepaway camp when I went to college every year, even all the way to as a senior. She's like, oh, I'm coming. I'm come help you move into your dorm. I'm like, mom, I'm like 21. Let me live. And so, but no. She calls me 3 times a day. I just wanted to showcase this family that is overwhelming with love and protection.
Yes. Yeah.
More questions? Don't be shy.
Mom. Oh, thank you very much. It's lovely to listen to you both. Danielle, I'm curious. I haven't read your book. I'm sorry. The Marvelers, the Conjurers, and were you thinking of the politics of the United States at all when you were writing those? Is there any influence?
Absolutely. So I was really thinking about fully that the Marvelers represent sort of this global society, whether it doesn't feel like America, it feels like maybe everyone, and that the Conjurers actually come from North America, Central America, South America, some spots in the Caribbean, because of wherever the slave trade touched, that's where they descend from. And I was really thinking about global anti-blackness, to be honest, and sort of how systems sort of support and keep out certain types of people, and they have to make concessions in order to join societies. I lived all over the world. I was very privileged. I lived in England and France and Japan, and I noticed, even amongst other in our diaspora, that certain people were included before others or had to make, you know what I mean, concessions or changes in order to be included. So Ella also has to face other black children at the school who also hold prejudices, and she has to sort of win them over because they are from other communities that are not Conjure communities. So they have to build a tentative bridge between them as well, and that's something that I experienced as a young person meeting people from the continent, from Africa and also from the Caribbean, where it's like, oh, we both have the same hair texture and skin tone, but we come from vastly different communities and we're lumped together and we're supposed to all connect. However, we have different experiences. And so I wanted to dive into that too. So I did use a little bit of American politics, obviously. You could lay the civil rights struggle alongside the events of the book. You can do that. It's for the teachers and librarians. But it's also talking globally about what happens to people who are descendants of chattel slavery. But kids probably won't pick up on those things. They're just like, oh, she's left out. That's great. We can start.
What I really loved about the book was you can read it on so many levels. You know, a young person's going to come to it and just find the school and these young people and this magic and this world, and an adult is going to have another gaze on it, and some adults are going to see one thing and others another. And I think that I was thinking about, you know, as a parent, having to sit through some of the insipid children's movies, and the ones that really worked for me were the ones that were tiered this way, where I could have my own jokes in it.
And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to remind adults of what it felt like to be a child reader, and then also have a world that can be a discussion point for young people, because young people understand insiders and outsiders, but they don't really know how that's crafted and created at an institutional level. And so the book is also told in found documents. I'm trash for a primary source, you know, librarians. So there's news articles, there's government documents for us to discuss how bias in our reporting and in the things that we write down create stigma that follow actual groups of people and influence what they can do and what they can't do. And, you know, the people going missing is a very large conversation that I think we don't ever want to talk about. So I wanted to make sure that that was in there too. So I did use a lot of, I was influenced a lot about American history, but also global history. Thank you for that question.
Hi. My question's about audiobooks. So I recently listened to The Rumor Game, and it included all these really great, like, sound effects, because a lot of it, you know, takes place with, like, social media, and it was something I hadn't seen before. And so you talked about, you know, Hollywood kind of changed your books when they go to screen, but do you have any kind of sway when it comes to how your book gets recorded?
Oh, that's such a great, because you can talk about audiobooks too. So, yes, I have a book called The Rumor Game, which is set in the D.C. area where I grew up, and it follows three girls in the destructive path of a rumor, and it's told in regular chapters but also in social media, because we didn't have social media when we were in high school, and it has changed the experience of what it means to be a high schooler. When they cannot escape the drama from school when they come home, it follows them on their phones 24/7. So it's a very stressful book. My apologies, because it's about that snowballing of, like, it doesn't matter what someone says about you online, whether or not it's true or not. If enough people believe it, it becomes the truth. And so they did what they wanted to do for the audiobooks. That's usually how it works for me. I don't get to really control. I get to talk about the narrators I want, but I don't get to do anything more than maybe pick a narrator. Huh. Do you have more say?
I do. I get to decide who's going to read it, and I get to decide when I'm going to read it, when I feel really connected to it, and what the music is going to be, and if it's going to be a fuller cast or a smaller cast. So, and it does help. And sometimes I listen to them. Most times I don't. So they might be doing what I'm asking them to do, but who knows? So I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, thank you guys so much for coming out here. So very small question. For someone that's interested in writing fantasy, what are tips or advice you would give to just get into that world, how to write in that format, and just any obsolete advice?
Well, that's such a great question to end with.
Right. If you want to write fantasy, you should be reading a ton of fantasy. I think I learned how to write fantasy from being a reader. And from figuring out what I liked and what I didn't like. And I do something that writers probably hate, but I will break a book. That means I will read it and I will chart it out, do a close reading, and find all of the strings that the author has left behind, all of their magic systems, how everything works, what are the rules of the magic, how do they influence, what are the consequences, and I make a chart. And I do that for books that I feel like I'm in that tradition. I always sort of, when I'm writing my magical books, I'm thinking, okay, who is this book in conversation with? Whose body of work? And then I study that body of work and do that sort of exercise of breaking down a fantasy book into its parts. And that exercise really taught me about what I like in terms of magic. And if you want to write magic, I can show you how to do that. But it sounds clinical, but it's a way to figure out how things work. And so that would be a start, figuring out your magic system and doing a ton of reading. And then also, I'm influenced a lot by TV. Oh, hello, Chicago. this is as bad as New York. It's been really loud here. I've been here for 4 days, and I'm like, this is louder than Harlem. But also, I watch a lot of TV and films that are fantastical, and I try to figure out how do I interact with that? How do I like this kind of magic or how it's depicted? And so I start there as well in those two things. What about some writing advice?
I'm just taking in your writing advice. I would love to know, and maybe you have it on your website or somewhere, a list of shows that you like to watch. I always follow Katherine Patterson's advice, which is big butt and chair.
Is that advice?
That advice is sit your butt in your chair and write. Because writing's a muscle, right? And if we don't use it, it atrophies. And I just think it's important to tell your stories and sit down and write them, and the rest will come. I think, if you have a story, I wrote on spec. I mean, I didn't have a contract when I wrote my first book. I just thought, this is a book I want to write. I'm going to write it and hope someone buys it. And I took a lot of writing classes. I still will take a writing class. I mean, this feels like a class because I'm learning so much from you, but a very entertaining class. but I do think that taking classes, being in places where you can write, where your writing's being supported, is really important, and writing,
which is the hardest part.
Yes.
Because you avoid it. Do you write every day?
No, I used to.
Oh, I don't write every day either. I can't.
Yeah.
I can do the charting. I can do some story thinking. People don't talk enough about the story thinking that one has to do.
That's so smart.
To figure out the puzzle pieces, to think, wait for those themes to bubble up, that thing that's bothering you and how it's going to infuse. So I write like 3 times a week.
Yeah, I do that, but I'm always thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about writing all the time, or the book I'm working on all the time, and so it is gestating, but yes, sitting down and the physical act happens less and less.
Less and less. Well, thank you so much for reading it and being in conversation with me.
Yay,
I appreciate it.
Thanks,
thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, bestselling author Ross Gay discusses his new essay collection, Inciting Joy. In these gorgeously written and timely pieces, Gay considers the joy we incite when we care for each other, especially during life's inevitable hardships. You can see Gay at AWM on November 1st at 6:30 p.m. Learn more and register at AmericanWritersMuseum.org/calendar. Now go. Be inspired and find the mind of a writer in yourself.